On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Stephen Novella explains what kind of research is needed to break the stalemate between skeptics and parapsychology researchers.
In the end, we have the same goal, even though we have different sort of approaches and different interpretations of things. And also, the goal is, just to put another point on this, is to design research that is carried out in such a way that it doesn't matter what you believe, that the results will be valid despite the belief of the researcher.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and we're joined today by the host of the very informative and entertaining podcast, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. That host being Dr. Stephen Novella, who we should also mention has another, I imagine, more than full-time job as a neurologist on the faculty at Yale University School of Medicine. And besides all that, he's the co-founder and president of the New England Skeptical Society. Dr. Novella, welcome to Skeptico.
It's a pleasure to be here, and please call me Steve.
Okay, I will. And Steve, you know, I have to say, from listening to so many of your podcasts, I feel like I know you, and I'm sure many of the listeners out there feel like they know you as well, and your whole crew there, as far as that goes. But that's kind of a good feeling to start a conversation, feel like there is this basis of understanding. But for those out there who maybe don't know about the Skeptic's Guide, can you tell us a little bit about, first of all, just what the podcast is all about, maybe a little bit about the origins of it and why you felt compelled to do it?
Sure. Well, this is a science podcast. It's a little bit over an hour long. It comes out weekly, and it's produced by our group, the New England Skeptical Society, and we collaborate with skeptchick.org, which is run by Rebecca Watson, who's on the panel with us. And we also occasionally collaborate with James Randi of the James Randi Education Foundation. And this is the latest project of ours. We've been doing this for about 10 years. I guess I could start by just saying how I got into the whole skeptical movement to begin with. It was basically my intro into skepticism was the creationism evolution issue. It was, you know, for me as a young person learning about science, and evolution was one of my favorite theories of science, still is. The notion that there was this organized group of people who had a whole bunch of really ridiculous things to say about evolution that were demonstrably wrong, and they were commanding a lot of public attention, was fascinating and frustrating for me. And that eventually led to sort of my interest in all things skeptical. And then about, I guess it's 11 years ago now, some friends of mine, my brothers and our friends, decided to form the Connecticut Skeptical Society, which then quickly became the New England Skeptical Society. And we've done a number of activities, but we got into podcasting 2 years ago, really pretty close to the beginning of the whole phenomenon of podcasting. It's been quite a steep learning curve for us. We really had no idea what we were doing at the beginning. You know, just a bunch of guys, you know, in our living rooms talking on the computer, basically. But it's been a wonderful experience. You know, what we try to do is to make science and skepticism fun and accessible, to try to talk about serious science issues, talk a lot about fringe science issues, while we're having a good time, basically. And the formula has really clicked, I think. I think it's, you know, we have a very growing audience. We're over 17,000 a week now. And it's been successful really beyond our dreams at this point.
It's a very entertaining show, as you mentioned. And I think at the same time, it is informative and you do tackle some pretty serious topics. You know, what I thought we might do today, because I've actually used a couple of the clips from your show to show maybe another side of skepticism, a side that I think sometimes gets in the way of science. And you know what I might start, because I think you kind of raised a very interesting, subtler point that I don't think it's drawn out enough. And that's the whole science versus religion, which you mentioned was really kind of the origins of your entree into this. And I guess I'm of the mindset that is a debate that's kind of past its usefulness. Not to say that there aren't a lot of people running around with these kind of trying to peddle these creationist ideas and the rest of this, but I just don't think serious people are, and there's a lot of not serious and a lot of not that well-educated people, but I don't think that's a theory that really is explored to any extent in academia or by serious people. That then gets in the way of some of these other issues that science really has to deal with, such as the ones that you talked about last week in terms of consciousness. I mean, it isn't necessarily tied to religion, and yet the skeptical argument always kind of leads it back to, oh, those darn creationists out there.
Yeah, although I don't think we specifically talked about religion on that issue. And just to clarify, you know, we've said this on our show, we do not frame this division as between science and religion. In fact, we do not deal with faith-based claims or personal choices of faith. Honestly, I don't care what people believe. It's not at all what our show is about. Well, we, one of our positions is that science should be free from intrusion by any ideology. That ideology does not have to be religious. It often is. But there are other ideologies that are not religious that could also intrude upon science. People could have social or political agendas, for example. A lot has been written in the last 6 years, you know, probably because of our current administration, about the intrusion of, you know, conservative political ideology into science. So that's our position. We don't care what people's religion are. We just don't want any ideology to subvert or pervert the process of science. It's all about process. If I could comment also, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, dealing with some of the issues that we deal with, some are intrusion of religion into science, some are silly, a lot are not very serious, and you think it gets in the way of the serious science end of the spectrum. And but just to clarify what are the niche that we are trying to fill with the Skeptic's Guide and with I think the skeptical movement as a whole, you know, it's not just about doing serious science. There are plenty of excellent science organizations out there that are highly professional, that are doing a good job. And, you know, I don't think that we would contribute significantly to, you know, the worldwide community of science in a totally straightforward way. What we are filling is a particular void. And, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. And I think there's a vacuum that is sucking us in, and that is being defined as the skeptical movement. And basically what we perceive is that there's a huge disconnect between science and the public. Scientists are largely uninterested in a lot of the issues that the public is fascinated with. The media, the mainstream media, is playing to public fascination and sensationalism. So they're doing a very poor job, in my opinion, of giving people accurate impressions and accurate information. For lots of reasons. The scientific community is largely ignoring it because they think it's not serious science. So the best thing to do is to just ignore it. Sometimes that's the right way to go. If somebody has an anonymous, obscure, wacky view that's not scientific, it does not deserve the attention of the scientific community. So it is best to ignore it. But when there are things like creationism, for example, that are commanding a large part of the public attention, I think the scientific community should get involved, and they're largely not. So on the other hand, there are many organizations that are promoting things that are on the fringe of science, or what I think are outside the realm of legitimate science, and they're largely being given a free pass. They're not really policing themselves. They're not aspiring to a quality of scholarship in science that I think is appropriate. And the mainstream scientific community are not giving them the peer review that would normally occur. So there's this huge vacuum, and that's what scientific skepticism is all about. We're trying to give serious peer review to areas where there isn't peer review, and we're trying to bridge the gap between the scientific community and the public where mainstream scientists are failing to do that.
You know, I guess I'd have two objections or kind of comebacks to that. And the first being that why not object to religious beliefs? I mean, I think that's a failing of the skeptical community. I read somebody like Sam Harris, and I say, yeah, stand up and say, I'm for truth-telling, and this is not truth-telling. And if you think your religious beliefs, Catholicism, Mormonism, whatever it is, if you think that's truth-telling, then stand up and make your case. But otherwise, you are not to be taken seriously in the world of ideas. And I don't know why there would be anything wrong with that. And as far as the second part, I think it's a very difficult. It could be spun either way. Is there the vacuum, or are you filling? Are you providing the, some role as kind of a self-appointed watchdog when the gatekeepers are already in place? I point out, and I've railed on my podcast here about sometimes the way that the skeptical community and your show and a couple of times have kind of ganged up on some pretty serious researchers. I mean, you take somebody like Dean Radin or Gary Schwartz, Rupert Sheldrake or Marilyn Schlitz. I mean, these people are not flying under the radar. They're at very highly esteemed universities. They're publishing in peer-reviewed papers. If you, we don't agree with their research areas or their conclusions, that's fine. But we can't point to I don't think we can. Maybe you can. I don't think it, you can point to them as being not scrutinized. They're pretty out there in the open.
All right. Well, let me deal with the first point first very quickly. And I don't want to get bogged down in this because we've talked about this for so long on our own podcast, and I've written tons about it. First of all, I don't speak for the whole skeptical community, and the skeptical community is largely split on this issue, and there's two camps. Those who believe, as you do, that we should treat religious claims and faith-based claims as any other claim. And there are those who think that, well, really the only important thing is to distinguish between faith and you know, truth in a scientific sense, and to keep things out of science that are not science. And I tend to fall more into that group. And it's not my business to tell somebody what they should believe in their heart of hearts. My point is, when you're operating within the realm of science, you have to follow the methods of science, and you have to have high standards of scholarship and sound logic and account for all the evidence, et cetera, et cetera. It may be a subtle distinction, but that's the distinction that we draw. And again, and I'll reinforce that there are definitely multiple schools of thought within the community on that. Regarding the second issue, and I've heard you make those points before on your podcast, I have to disagree with you on all the points that you made. First of all, you know, it is true that we are quote unquote self-appointed. You know, we've decided to do this as our hobby, and because we want to make the world a more skeptical place. I gain no other benefit from all of this activity. It sucks away my time and resources, and I do it because I believe in it. But it's not so much that we're the watchdogs, it's that we're trying to provide a kind of analysis that I really don't think is happening. You say that a lot of these people are serious scientists. And first of all, let me point out that you're talking about the most serious end of a very broad spectrum that we deal with, you know, because we deal with the whole spectrum. We deal with out-and-out frauds and con artists. We deal with people who are hopelessly self-deluded. We deal with people who are anti-scientific. And we also deal with people who respect science, think that they're doing good science, but I think are just falling below a reasonable standard of science. They're making some kind of systematic mistake. I don't think that the kind of peer review that is necessary is going on. A lot of these people publish in journals that are peer reviewed by other people who believe what they do, and not by the broader scientific community. And I think that's a gap that needs to be filled. As I said, the mainstream scientists, you know, often do not give the time of day to this end of the spectrum, to this fringe kind of research. They think it's kind of tainted because it's silly. Why do we feel we need to quote unquote gang up on these people? Well, you miss the point that all of the people that you mention publish their ideas directly to the public. You interviewed Dean Radin before, and sure, he has his Untangled Minds book that he's selling to the public. So they're not restricting themselves to a conversation within the published literature, within the scientific community. They're going directly to the public to try to sell them on their claims. And what we're doing is we're going to the public and we're giving an alternate view. We're saying, well, no, we disagree with their interpretation of this evidence. We think there are these problems with the evidence. We're pointing out that there are other scientists who have a different view of the evidence and interpret it differently. So if they weren't publishing books and going on Oprah and discussing their views in very public forums, we wouldn't feel the need to address it to the public. What do you say to that?
Two corrections. One, when I was talking about that, I wasn't talking about the Skeptics Guide in particular. I was talking about the skeptical community and the overall effect that it's had on this area of research. I think you did a good job of talking about the spectrum of researchers, and the spectrum is certainly out there, which is another complaint that I have with the skeptical community. They seem to be backing off of this turn of debunking. Boy, I think that's one of the real services that the skeptical community can do is debunk totally false claims. My problem still comes into when we get into the area of real science. You know, I was just listening before our podcast because I wanted to hear your interview with Sue Blackmore. And
yeah.
It was an interesting interview. The main point, though, is that the existence of a consciousness that mm-hmm. is separate from the brain is a very undecided scientific point. There are many, many very, very smart people. I just talked to one earlier today that are of a different opinion. There is not solid empirical data for one way or another. Now, you may lean one way or another, but it's a fundamentally critical issue to be explored. We can agree mm-hmm. on that. And then secondly, I think we can agree that it's not settled one way or another. So my frustration is when someone enters into this domain and they're qualified and they're trying to do good work, why do we want to jump on them? And I'll let you respond to that. And then I want to follow up with, you know, in particular, Marilyn Schlitz when she was on your show.
Well, again, what we jump on are people who commit logical fallacies, who misrepresent the evidence, who ignore factors in their research that we feel are critical to putting it in the proper perspective. Again, it's methods, really, that we jump on, that we criticize. And I think our criticisms are legitimate. Including, you know, of all the people that you mentioned. With regard specifically to consciousness, sure, absolutely, there are things we do not know, and we do not have a fully fleshed out model of exactly how consciousness is created and how it works. But that doesn't mean that all propositions are equal in the eyes of science.
Of course,
and
not.
And it also, I think you may be slipping into what we call the argument from ignorance by saying we don't know. Therefore, I'm sort of free to propose or have these other beliefs.
I'm really suggesting that there is real evidence to suggest that an alternative theory might be valid and is worth exploring. Not just that since we don't know anything is possible. I'm saying there's serious people doing serious work, getting results that are suggestive that the kind of materialistic consciousness doesn't fit. I'm not saying it's true or not. I'm saying it's a valid area of scientific inquiry.
Well, you know, you and I disagree on the interpretation of the evidence, and that's fine. And again, the purpose of, you know, what we do is more a conversation than anything else. We're not trying. I mean, some people react to us as if we think we're making some sort of definitive pronouncement on what is valid or what is true. It's nothing. It's a conversation. This is the kind of conversation that happens within science. And the kind of discussion that the scientific community has of itself, of very non-controversial, very mundane ideas, is extremely critical. And what strikes me a lot in our conversation, you know, to and about the researchers that you're referring to, is that they just strike me as thin-skinned. It's like, you know, you have to hold up a little bit better under the kind of critical analysis and scrutiny that is actually, this is what happens day in, day out. I mean, if you ever tried to publish a paper in a peer-reviewed journal, you know what criticism is, and scientists do not pull their punches. So I think that they need, and that's, I think, part of that gap that we're talking about. It's like, you know, why are you so scared of this kind of criticism? This is how we figure out what's valuable and what's not valuable. Now, in terms of consciousness, you know, my interpretation, having looked at the evidence as I have, and again, this is, I'm not claiming, you know, any special expertise in every area that touches upon this, but I am a neurologist, so I have some idea about, you know, about brain science. I think that the all of the phenomena that have been clearly established are compatible with a purely materialistic view of brain function. And that's where the vast majority of the science is taking place. That's what scientists are doing. I noticed on your Wikipedia entry that you characterized as a free market guy with a libertarian-leaning pragmatist. So you appreciate free market forces. Well, you know, science is a pretty free market meritocracy. Scientists decide what to do research on based upon where they think they're going to get the most bang for the buck. You know, young researchers looking for something to investigate want to make a difference. You know, they want to investigate something that is going to pan out, that is going to be interesting for them. And they tend to follow those areas that are fruitful. Well, you know what? Neuroscientists are looking at very very reductionist, very physical mechanisms of how the brain works and also how consciousness is formed. You're talking about, you know, it seems that as if you are putting up against a very robust, large, mainstream area of science, you're putting a few fringe, very controversial scientists up against them, and I don't think that those two things are equal. And when you delve into that research, the more of the controversial fringe research, what you interpret as compelling evidence for a non-physical means of consciousness, you know what? I don't find it compelling. Most scientists do not find it compelling, and largely it's just unnecessary. A lot of it hypothesizes things that are either untestable or completely unnecessary. We really don't need a non-physical explanation for all of the phenomena that we've observed so far.
I don't know. There's so many points to respond to there. It's not as simple in talking to many parapsychology researchers. They paint a very, very different picture of the reality of what their life is like in terms of trying to get funding for this research, trying to get a PhD that specializes in this research, trying to find a place to conduct this research. It's the environment, whether the skeptical community has contributed to this environment or not, is very, very, very unfriendly to this kind of research. So those are also the free market forces.
Can I just add a point before we go? And then I'll be happy to talk with you about near-death experiences. But, you know, one of the benefits that I found of being in the skeptical community is that I've looked at hundreds of different kinds of fringe or controversial or pseudosciences, and you begin to see patterns that I think are very instructive for me. And you know, so you mentioned that parapsychologists have found a very, very unfriendly environment to try to get funding and do research. Well, you know, I hear the exact same complaints from intelligent design proponents. And you know what? I think you have the cause and effect reversed. It's not that good research isn't being done because the environment isn't friendly. The environment isn't friendly because there's no meat there, because scientists look at that area and they don't see the theoretical or empirical justification for putting resources into it. If in the last 100 years, parapsychological researchers had produced some genuinely compelling and interesting results that really stood up over time and didn't evaporate when they were looked at more closely, then that wouldn't be the case. It wouldn't be an unfriendly environment. In fact, if there was really solid evidence of any psi phenomenon, people, scientists, both physicists and psychologists and neuroscientists, would be all over it, because that would be such a fruitful area of research, and institutions would be happy to fund it and would open up departments in order to get at the leading edge of that research. We don't see that happening. You know, science is like a freeway. If it gets a lot of traffic, the road gets expanded. If it's not fruitful, it leads nowhere, the road is left fallow. I think parapsychology is fallow because it hasn't produced the results that would compel mainstream scientists.
You know, I heard that argument over and over again. I've heard it. And when I first really started exploring this area, that argument had a lot more weight to it than it does to me now. But let me instead switch to exactly your point, and I want to talk about the work of Dean Radin and then the counterclaims that were made by Ray Hyman on your show. So let me play a couple of clips, and then I want to get your response.
Sure.
But what's fascinating about Radin is that he comes through at first as being very sophisticated, and yet he gets results, and then he never repeats that. He never does drop, and he goes on to other stuff. And as a cynic, you wonder, well, why? What happened here? Why does no one else follow up? Why does he follow up his own great work, right? Then I found out some other things. When I went through his presentiment work, I went through and I found, it took me a while to find it, that, hey, he'd done 3 experiments, each replicated the other. But when I go down to the fancy way that he was correcting for baselines and stuff like that, the correction was one way in one experiment. The second experiment was a different correction. The third experiment was a different correction. And then I realized I did some simulations, and the corrections from the first experiment would almost, and the one in the second experiment would cancel each other out. In other words, who would give you a different result? And why would he always changing his corrections? And I'm realizing that this is a subtle kind of, maybe unconscious or conscious, I'm not sure which, way of making sure you're going to get what you want from your data.
So, Steve, did you hear that okay?
Yeah, I did.
So I have to say, when I first heard that, I thought, wow, this is pretty compelling. I mean, here's a smart guy who's obviously dug into this stuff, and he's come to these conclusions. So we had Dean Radin on the show and asked him to directly address some of the points. So I have two different clips addressing that. So let me play them, and then I want to get your response.
Well, it's interesting. His first comment is that I do a lot of studies and don't repeat them. And the very next thing is saying that I repeated the presentiment experiment a number of times. So there's a bit of a contradiction there. The issue on doing lots of experiments and, quote, never repeating them, I've heard this kind of criticism before, and I think it usually comes out of people in a tenured academic position where they may never have worked outside of academia, and they've had tenure so long that they don't remember that oftentimes you don't get a chance to decide what you're going to work on. You work on what the available grants will allow you to work on.
So that was the first point, and I guess I'd add to that Radin went on to point out that, you know, these studies take 1 to 2 years from the time of conception to publication. So, and that this one in particular, presentiment, has been replicated 9 times by 3 university labs around the world. But the fact that he's done it 3 times is, you know, a nice hunk of life that he's kind of taken there. Do you want to respond to that, or should I go ahead and play the second one?
Well, yeah, I can respond to that before you do the second point. So, again, it's hard for me to know exactly what Ray Hyman, you know, was thinking when he said what he said. But in terms of the lack of, follow through, I'll just give you what my impression is of the parapsychological research. Now, I'm obviously, I'm a practicing clinical physician as well as doing some clinical research, and I collaborate on some basic science research within my department. And I've also just have a lifelong interest in science. So I have some sense of, how science evolves in a field. Even in a difficult field like medicine, where studies can take years to do, that, the pattern of research that we see is that there is some preliminary research maybe exploring a new avenue or a new idea or a new concept. If it garners some significant results, then you see a research program. And a research program may carry out dozens of or score even hundreds of experiments, maybe within a lab or a collaboration among multiple labs, where it's a building process where you generate hypotheses, you answer those hypotheses, that generates still new questions, still new hypotheses, and you keep going slowly building, piecing together a picture of what you're studying, of reality. What you see when you look at areas of research, even areas of research that have been going on for decades or even 100 years or longer, when the underlying phenomenon is not genuine, in my opinion, what the pattern of research that you see is that it seems to be going around in circles. It's constantly trying to just prove the very existence of what it's looking at without ever really having a research program that has a consistent a progress of building on itself and answering new questions in a way that generates even further questions and builds. So this is true, for example, of the research into homeopathy or astrology and many, many things. And it's also, in my opinion, true if you step back and look at the course of research in parapsychology, you see the same basic pattern. It's not progressing. It's not building. It's not a research program. It's just going around in circles, trying to get on base, trying to take the first step, which is establish convincingly that the phenomenon even exists. And even Dean Radin, admits that the research that he's done so far does not establish, to a reasonable degree that this is real. He says it needs to be replicated. We need to do more research. Other people need to do it so that it can't be written off as the quirkiness of my own methods or my own lab.
Right, but isn't that really the point? I mean, I want to play the second part of it because it's really the heart of it. But,
yeah.
You've just kind of given me a good case for how it should happen.
Yeah.
But it doesn't happen that way. So here's a guy who has replicated it. Back to your earlier point, Steve, where's the highway? Where's everyone racing to replicate this experiment over and over again?
Because we're not buying it because it's not compelling. You find it compelling, but we don't find it compelling. And that's what really, Alex, but that's really what we should be focusing on. Why do you find it compelling when I don't? And I admit that on both sides, there's a lot of dismissiveness. And listening to your podcast, you and your guests have said a lot of things that are extremely dismissive of skeptics, which also strikes me as a little bit hypocritical when you criticize us for being dismissive of parapsychologists. And I think we need to move past that and focus on the only thing that really matters is what is the evidence, what's the analysis, and why is it that we're coming to different conclusions? And I'm not talking about why psychologically, because that's just a way of dismissing the people who disagree with you. I'm talking about why methodologically. And when you get down to it, you know, our interpretation of the evidence is different for very serious, very meaningful, real reasons. And I don't think that you guys really appreciate where we're coming from.
Okay, I think that's a perfect lead-in for this second clip, because my point in playing these clips was to really point out my journey here, is to say,
yeah,
you know, I'm here. I'm a layperson. I'm nowhere near as qualified on a scientific basis to analyze these claims as you are. And I have not published in a peer-reviewed journal as you have. And I really, really respect the thought and the work that goes into that. So here I am. And I listened to the second part of this, and I've listened to some of your points on meta-analysis. But let me play this, and then let's talk about this, because this is data that I find hard to dismiss.
It's not very useful to do an experiment and just keep using the same old statistics each time. I want to advance both the method and the analysis every single time. So I try to come up with more and more sensitive ways of getting a result. But it is also true that when you want to create a mini meta-analysis of your own results, it becomes very important to see whether you can take the most recent analytical tool and apply it to all of the data that you've collected uniformly, so that you're no longer mixing and matching different analyses, but you're using the same method. So in 2004, when I published all of the presentiment studies that I've done to that point, I used the same statistical method for every single trial, and overall you end up with a very, very significant result. So that counteracts his complaint about use of different methods, and that I used the most recent method, which I think was the best, and I applied it uniformly to all of the data.
So you were a minute ago getting on me for being dismissive, which I'm sure I have. You know, we all get riled up on these subjects and
right.
Can kind of get pretty far out there. But see, here's the kind of gets down to the point. Here's a guy, he's done this work, and I don't want to go too far. I want to hear your analysis.
Sure.
But the date I want to pull out, he published his work in 2004. Why is Ray Hyman talking about the previous independent studies that he's done? Why not, if he's being upfront, why not address the 2004 little mini meta-analysis where there's really only one statistical bias or formula that he's using?
Well, again, I can't speak for Ray Hyman, but I mean, it seems like you're suggesting that he was being dishonest. And knowing him personally, I don't think that that is a fair assessment. I think that the easiest explanation is that he wasn't aware of the most recent analysis. I think
unacceptable.
If he were aware of it, he probably would have talked about it. But again, I'm just speculating because I don't know. I could ask him.
Steve, that's just really frustrating. I mean, here's a guy who kind of makes his claim that he is read more parapsychology articles than anyone. I mean, I think he said that directly. For you to say he wasn't aware of the guy that does a meta-analysis of his own work, so this claim by Radin now stands unchallenged, countering what Hyman said. So again, I'm a lay person. I come in and I'm listening here, and this is all settled. There isn't any good research. And I'm saying, well, why isn't this good research? Why isn't this interesting enough to create a highway?
Well, you know, again, I can't answer for Ray Hyman. I'm sure he has an answer. And I will ask him that because I'm interested in what his answer to that is. But I don't think we could make assumptions, especially self-serving assumptions, about why he said what he did. But you know, the thing is, it takes time for the research to work itself out. And for example, and you find you seem to be stuck on this notion of why isn't the scientific community really compelled by this, and you really should be very serious about that question. You should really ask yourself that question. I think that the people who are compelled by paranormal research are too easy to leap to answers to that question, which are a bit self-serving and which actually short-circuit the real discussion that we should be having. For example, and again, I could quote people who have been on your show, that we scoff, we're dogmatic, we're protecting our worldview, we are protecting our materialistic assumptions, we don't base our opinions on the evidence, we base them on our a priori assumptions. When you say things like that, you're short-circuiting the real discussion that should be happening. The real discussion is, what is different about that research from other research that is causing the scientific community to respond so differently to it? And let me answer that question. First of all, I think that there is the issue of prior probability, which is a very real issue in science. And scientists consider this every day. When you review a paper, when you review a grant request, you do a very serious analysis of everything we know. And is the hypothesis that's being presented before me consistent with the mountain of evidence that we've already collected about reality, about what science knows? Not to do that is to basically deny all of pre-existing scientific discovery. And when you're dealing with an area where the prior probability is extremely low because there's no plausible mechanism, and in fact it seems to defy what has already been well established in science, then the threshold for evidence is higher. So the first reason why we're not compelled is that our threshold for evidence starts out pretty high. It's not infinite. You can convince me, but it's higher than it would be for something that is a mundane, small baby step extension of what we already know, for example. The second is that we know that, one lab is never going to be compelling. We need to see that this is a research program, and we need a lot of questions answered. And you have to approach each question from multiple different angles. I've sat in grand rounds listening to scientists talk about their research, and the experience is just so different from listening to the parapsychologists talk about their research. And it's a very, very important difference. The neuroscientists who are talking about looking at protein receptors and their effect in the spinal cord is really just, nitty-gritty, mundane, reductionist, neuroscience. They are so skeptical of their own research. They try to find every single way you could knock down what they're trying to say, and then they research it from 3, 4, 5, 6 different angles before they present the research. They're giving you a series of research where they've looked at the question from multiple different angles. And then I listen to Radin and Marilyn Schlitz and Schwartz and those guys, and it's a completely different feel. What they're saying is they have this, a fairly narrow research. It has no prior plausibility. They don't really have any explanation for it, and there's lots of unanswered questions about what the implications are, and the effect size is typically right at the limit of detection. It's also, which is another factor that makes it not compelling, and the statistics are always confusing and they're not straightforward. And then when they're met with, and rather than being skeptical of themselves, they react to hostility to the skepticism of others. It's a very different process. And as long as that process stays that way, they're not going to gain the mainstream respect that they're looking for. It may be that they never find it because what they're looking for doesn't exist. I think that's the most likely explanation. Although, again, I'm perfectly willing to revise my opinion if a sufficient body of high quality enough evidence comes to light. But again, It hasn't. This kind of research that you find compelling, even if it were addressing a very mundane issue, I would find preliminary. You combine the fact that it's preliminary with that it would require overturning major areas of basic science, and that gulf is not being breached.
You make some points that I think I would agree with, as you always do on your show as well as here. I do think we kind of slip into a different mode of speaking, though. My real point on playing those clips was that Ray Hyman should know better. And, you know, your point was there really isn't anything out there because there isn't anything out there. And my point was, gee, when I look into it and I look at these serious the people I think are serious, and I think there's a lot of non-serious people in this field, I find questions that lead to more questions that are preliminary but do deserve more work. And that's why I don't understand why the skeptical community and parapsychologists, at least parapsychology researchers, aren't joined at the hip and saying, while there's a real interest among the public, which there clearly is, to understand whether survival of consciousness exists, whether consciousness exists, let's go find this out. So, I mean, I don't know why we're not cheering these guys on and throwing tons of money, which is kind of the opposite case.
I'm never take the position that people shouldn't be doing research. Research away. Go ahead. People should research what they're interested in. And I even believe that, you know, although we should be putting most of our resources in sort of high yield, high probability research, we want to hedge our bets and look at low probability research as well. Absolutely. We need to be putting a little bit of resources in that as well. I'm not criticizing people for doing research. I criticize them for how they interpret that research, especially when they interpret that research to the public rather than trying to convince their scientific peers more directly and then let the community decide what's real and what's not real. That's what we criticize, so don't make that mistake. But listen, I would be happy to cooperate in definitive research, and that's what happens in real science too. Again, even on mundane questions, you have two schools of thought, two groups that interpret all the existing evidence with opposite conclusions. That happens on just simple, you know, non-controversial questions as well. And then what happens is eventually they criticize each other. They criticize each other back and forth and their interpretations and their evidence and their methods, and it could get very heated and it gets very detailed. And then they build a consensus and eventually they design studies that everybody agrees are the right kind of studies to do and account for all the prior criticisms. Then definitive studies get done with both, you know, people on both sides participating. It's multi-centered, so there's your sort of any kind of quirkiness gets averaged out, hopefully over multiple different centers. And then you get some results, and then everybody believes the new results, and then you end up with one school of thought, and the people who were wrong say, we were wrong, this is what the evidence shows, let's move on. That hasn't happened here. And I think it's a really good question why it hasn't happened here. I don't want to fall into the trap of, you know, both sides blaming the other side. I think there's probably legitimate blame to go around on both sides. But the bottom line is, part of it, I can only tell you why, from the skeptic's point of view, why I think that this hasn't happened. I think partly we think, well, you know what, we're here, we're willing to do it. But I think that there's a resistance to the kind of pointed criticism that we bring to it that a lot of you know, paranormal researchers frankly don't want. Also, I think that a lot of skeptics think, well, hasn't it already been done? I mean, hasn't 100 years of paranormal research been enough? And there's with that is coupled with the senses, and we do get a little fatigue in that we see over and over again, and again, I'm talking about the full breadth of skepticism here, and sometimes, you know, we may become a little cynical from the more wacky stuff, and it may taint our view of the more reasonable stuff. I admit that. You know, we're all humans. We make mistakes. But what I see is that when definitive evidence comes out that demonstrates that a pseudoscientific or paranormal phenomenon is not real, the proponents never relent, ever. Ever, ever. So there's a very legitimate question from our end is what's the point? We're never going to convince them. But I'm willing to put that aside if you guys are willing to put it aside. We're certainly, we believe we're willing to be convinced it's true. I hope you're willing to be convinced it's not true. And if you'll make that pledge, then we can cooperate and do the definitive tests that will, and I'd love to answer this question definitively. I'd love to have definitive evidence. You know, it is frustrating, just as frustrating for me when experts disagree on how to interpret the evidence, you know, and you can't get to a final definitive answer. I find that just as frustrating as you do. I'd love to have unequivocal, absolutely definitive evidence. Let's get it.
I second that and third it and fourth it. And I have to say, in listening to your broadcast, I definitely have gotten the sense that you are that kind of person who does want to know and is unafraid to go where the data takes you. And I have the highest regard and the highest respect for that, because I do feel that I am of that same belief. And I will state just my support of everything that you said, and it actually leads into a project that I'm starting, and I would very much like your mm-hmm. help and support on it. And the idea is open source science to really bridge the gap between researchers of these controversial areas and their skeptics, because I couldn't agree more that there isn't enough of that going on. And I think that the web, as you and I can both attest to from our experience mm-hmm. with our podcast, has a great
Absolutely.
Enabling force for bringing people together, bringing in divergent views. I mean, I think part of the discussion that would really be enriched by people from completely different areas, completely different disciplines, to come in and say, you know, I'm from the zoology department, and here's how we do animal-human behavior studies, and this is how you should do it in this case. So I think that's great, and I would really like to take you up on that offer and take your listeners up on that offer and see if we can get a true collaboration going to really, in the spirit of really discovery,
yeah.
finding out whether it's true or it's not.
Absolutely. You know, I think we have to recognize that in the end we have the same goal, even though we have different sort of approaches and different interpretations of things. And also the goal is, just to put another point on this, is to design research that is carried out in such a way that it doesn't matter what you believe, that the results will be valid despite the belief of the researcher. And when you could design studies that are like that, then you can trust the results, and everybody can trust the results, and then we'll come to a consensus. Although I'll say that the skeptical point of view is that often that does get done, including in some paranormal areas, that the research does evolve to the point where you get really well-designed studies, and that the effects tend to go away when that happens. But I understand that there's room for even more research, and again, whatever the result of that research is the result of that research.
And I think that is the case sometimes. And I think your frustration is understandable, that you know, you can never beat them down, that there's always something else. There's that element of the parapsychology research that, oh, then the experimenter effect is subtler, without getting into all that. What I think we should do is, I'm going to go forward with this. We're already going forward with it. And I will definitely elicit your support and the support of your many, many, many fans out there to come with an open mind mm-hmm. and see if we can help shine light on this. You are a scientist. I'm not a scientist. But I think what we've found in our podcast is that there's a lot of really smart people out there. There's a lot of intellect that can be tapped into in an open source way that can provide a real contribution and can help the real scientists move this whole thing forward.
Yeah, I'll also say that even though I don't think that psi exists, this area is an interesting area of research, because the fact that people believe in it, that's an interesting phenomenon. You know, that is interesting, that humans come to this conclusion, that there's something going on in our experience of ourselves and of our lives that leads a lot of people to believe that these things are happening. And if we understand that, that may go a lot. That's an alternative hypothesis that you guys can't dismiss, that may ultimately lead to the best explanation of this whole field.
Very good. Well, Steve, you've been very generous with your time and have provided a lot of good nuggets here to think about. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about what's coming up on Skeptic's Guide, and maybe with you personally?
Well, you know, the Skeptic's Guide, we kind of decide our topics week to week based upon what's in the news and the email questions that we get, and we're usually scheduling guests last minute. We do have Barry Beierstein coming on, and we have Fraser and Pamela from AstronomyCast coming on in the next couple of weeks, so we're looking forward to that. I've been very active with Neurologica, which is my blog, which has gotten me into another internet community of educators and scientists. It's been a really great experience, and we're always looking to expand what we do. You know, again, our agenda is the public understanding of science. That's ultimately what we're all about, and it's certainly an endless uphill battle it's kind of a labor of love. So we're always looking for new things to do.
Well, that's great, and I definitely see you as a force for good, someone who's out there trying to make the world a better place, which I think is what it's really all about. And I think we can have very different views about how that should happen, but ultimately it's the energy that we put forth and kind of moving it forward that really matters.
Yeah, I mean, this is the way science works. We disagree and we argue about it, and in the end, hopefully we'll hammer our way towards the scientific truth. We never had a chance to talk about near-death experiences. Maybe you'll have me back and we'll talk about it.
Oh, I'd love to have you back anytime your schedule permits. But thanks again for joining us, and I'll be in touch on open source science as well and see if we can collaborate some more.
Great. I look forward to it.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks. Pleasure.
Thanks again to Dr. Novella for joining us today. If you'd like more information and a link to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, please check out our website at skeptico.com. That's skeptiko.com, where you can also see links to our former shows. You can see a link to drop us a comment, an email, or dial us up and give us a voicemail. And also, with this broadcast, we're also announcing the launch of opensourcescience.net, a very exciting project where we are actually going to be helping scientists through the form of grants replicate some of the work that we've discussed on here. And we've gotten some great support from the skeptical community that's really gotten behind this and seem to think that this is a sensible way forward for both skeptics and controversial scientists to join forces, find out what the right protocols are for definitive experiments, and then to see those experiments replicated. So if you'd like more information about that, please go to opensourcescience.net. You'll also find a link to that on our website. And I think with that, it's going to about do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.